Hi everyone, I'm Josh, and this is The Emerald, Currents and Trends Through a Mythic Lens, the podcast where we explore an ever-changing world and our lives in it through the lens of myth, story, and imagination. The Emerald, all that's happening on this green jewel in space. Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of The Emerald, Currents and Trends Through a Mythic Lens. What can we learn from those who can read the ocean like we can read words on a page? How can we transform how we view culture when modern Western culture likes to position itself as the top of the cultural pyramid? What does a vision of sacred geography have to offer us? What are its implications for planet and person? A discussion today with anthropologist and ethnobotanist Wade Davis. If you don't know the work of Wade Davis, you should. Davis is a Canadian anthropologist, ethnobotanist, author, and photographer whose work has focused on worldwide Indigenous cultures. He came to prominence with his 1985 best-selling book, The Serpent and the Rainbow, about the zombies of Haiti. He is professor of anthropology and the British Columbia Leadership Chair in Cultures and Ecosystems at Risk at the University of British Columbia. He's also an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, which has to be one of the coolest job titles ever. I wanted to speak with Wade about several topics. I've been fascinated for a very long time with the Polynesian navigators, who traveled the length and breadth of the Pacific Ocean without modern navigational tools, reading fractal patterns of waves and reflections on the undersides of clouds. I wanted to start to understand more about the mind that can read five simultaneous sea swells, distinguishing those caused by local weather patterns from those of the deep ocean currents. So I asked Wade about Polynesia, and he took me on a much larger odyssey, outlining his work for National Geographic and where it's taken him and what he's seen and observed. Davis partnered with National Geographic on a mission with the daunting task of transforming how human beings view culture. They sought to do this, as he says, not through polemics or politics, but by illuminating stories from cultures around the world that are all attempts to answer that fundamental question, what does it mean to be human? Here's Wade Davis.
We had this enormous audience at the National Geographic, and why not take them to places around the world where the cultural beliefs and practices were so dazzling that they couldn't help but be embraced with a new kind of sense of appreciation. And this all goes back to a fundamental revelation of our era, which is key to this whole story, which is the fact that geneticists over the last 20 years have finally proven philosophers to be true. We really are all brothers and sisters. And I don't mean that in the spirit of hippie ethnography. I mean, studies of the human genome have left no doubt whatsoever that the genetic endowment of humanity is a continuum. Race is an utter fiction. We're all cut from the same genetic cloth, and science would say that we're all descendants of that same handful of people who walked out of Africa some 85,000 years ago, and then embarked on this incredible human journey that carried our spirit to every corner of the habitable world. But the important thing about that revelation of genetics is that if we all share the same endowment, by definition, we all share the same raw genius. And critically, how that genius is expressed is simply a matter of choice and cultural orientation. We in the West may celebrate technological wizardry. Other peoples may place that same raw human genius into the complex task of unraveling the mystic threads of memory inherent in a myth.
So the sentences that Wade Davis speaks are packed with a lot of information, and I want to repeat something he just said because it forms a central theme of this podcast. right? He's saying that while one culture may value external technological innovation, other cultures may put that exact same effort towards story or ritual or exploring consciousness. And what's key is that this does not make one culture better than another. Each one is its own expression of genius. And in a world where modern Western technological culture tends to be dominant, I think it's worth highlighting some other ways of seeing the world, some other ways of being.
Culture, that old 19th century idea of evolutionary anthropology inspired by Darwin, that we somehow evolved from the savage to the barbarian to the civilized to the strand of Europe, that, you know, that European, particularly Victorian English society, stood on the apex of the pyramid that sloped down the sides to the so-called primitives of the world, has absolutely been debunked and ridiculed by modern science, shown to be a colonial conceit as irrelevant to our lives today, is a notion that clergymen had in that era, that the earth was but 6,000 years old. And so in a stunning affirmation of Franz Boas's intuition about cultural relativism, science has come to the fore. And what this means, of course, is that the other peoples of the world aren't failed attempts at being modern. They're not failed attempts at being us. Every culture, by definition, is a unique answer to a fundamental question. What does it mean to be human and alive? And when the peoples of the world answer that question, they do so in the 7,000 extant languages of humanity. And those answers in those languages collectively become our kind of human repertoire for dealing with the challenges that will confront us in the coming decades and indeed the coming centuries. So this is the lesson of anthropology. Every culture's got something to say. Each deserves to be heard, just as none has a monopoly on the route to the divine. And in this sense, as Ruth Benedict, one of Boas's great students, said, the purpose of anthropology is to make the world safe for human differences. You know, the purpose of anthropology, in a sense, is to infect the world with the virus of tolerance. Anthropology, in that sense, is the antidote to the nativism of someone like Donald Trump. And cultural myopia, this idea that my world is the real world and everybody else is a failed attempt at being me, has in fact been the curse of humanity since the dawn of consciousness. You know, I mean, most tribal societies, their names mean the people, the implication being the blokes over the hill are savages. You know, the word barbarian comes from the Greek barbarous, one who babbles. If you didn't speak Greek, you didn't exist. When Herodotus, 400 years before Christ, came back from his journeys and had the audacity in Athens to say that there was something interesting going on over there in a place we now call Persia, Plato wanted him killed for the gall of saying that anything interesting could exist outside of the Greek realm. So that kind of cultural myopia, which is at the foundation of all conflict to this day, is something that we can't tolerate in a multicultural, pluralistic, engaged, globalized world. So what do you do about it? And that gets us back to Polynesia. You know, let's take our audience to places where the beliefs can't help but impress you. And you cited that sort of line that if you took all the genius that allowed us to put a man on the moon, applied it to understand the ocean, what you would get is Polynesia. Well, we always, in all these films we made in this initiative, we always try to have a kind of, not a cute line, but an organizing line that would sort of tell us what the film was going to be all about. And so, for example, when we made a film on the Buddhist science of the mind, the kind of line there was something that was told to me directly by a lama in Tibet when he said that, you know, we in Tibet don't believe that you went to the moon, but you did. You may not believe that we achieve enlightenment in one lifetime, but we do. And so in the case of Polynesia, it was such a wonderful example of this because we could demonstrate it in a living culture today through the journeys of the Polynesian Voyaging Society and the Hokulea, which is the sacred, named after the sacred star of Hawaii, this extraordinary vessel that became the transporter of culture, the what Nainoa Thompson calls the rocket ship of the ancestors. And, you know, we know for a fact, for example, that, you know, to this day, the navigators can sense the presence of distant atolls of islands beyond the visible horizon simply by watching the reverberation of waves across the hull of the vessel, knowing full well that every island group has its own unique refractive pattern that can be read with the same perspicacity with which a scientist would read a fingerprint. We know that in the darkness of the hull of the vessel, they can distinguish five sea swells moving through the canoe, separating those caused by local weather disturbances from the deep currents that pulsate across the ocean, and can be followed as a terrestrial explorer would follow a river to the sea. You know, these are sailors who can name 220 stars in the night sky, and their entire tradition of navigation was based on dead reckoning. And dead reckoning means you only know where you are by remembering how you got there. And it was the impossibility of using that kind of methodology on the long oceanic voyage that kept most European transports hugging the shores of continents until the British solved the problem of longitude with the invention of the chronometer. But we know for scientific fact that 10 centuries before Christ, the ancestors of the Polynesians from an ancient civilization we called Lapita off the shores of New Guinea and set sail to the rising sun. In 1,000 years, they reached Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, and then they stopped for 10 centuries. But then they sailed on across the Pacific to the Marquesas, northwest to Hawaii, southeast to Rapa Nui or Easter Island, eventually reaching Aotearoa, what we now call New Zealand. And this meant that in a tradition that lacked the written word, the navigator, over the course of a long journey, had to sit monk-like on the stern of the vessel, remembering every sign of the stars, the sun and the moon, the sea, the flight of birds, the movement of marine life, and not only remembering what happened, but the order of the acquisition of that knowledge. And if that continuity of information, that stream of knowledge was severed, were he or she to fall asleep, for example, the voyage could end in disaster. And yet that is how we know that the Polynesians settled the greatest ocean sphere on the face of the planet.
The greatest ocean sphere on the face of the planet, the greatest global spread of culture by area the world had ever known, and would remain so until the Victorian era, and most of it was water. Shining water from the Solomon Islands to Easter Island to Hawaii to New Zealand, navigated by memory. What is it like to hold 220 stars in memory? How many stars can you name right now? For me, Polaris, Arcturus, Aldebaran, Sirius, Betelgeuse, Denebola, Rex Leonis, Ras El Asad. But could I pick them all out in the night sky on the high seas? Not at all, and that's less than 10 stars. Can we imagine a geography of the mind in which miles and miles of rippling, swelling ocean become familiar territory of the consciousness, a shifting scape of meticulous memorization, in which kinesthetic awareness is attuned to minute changes in ocean current? Kinesthetic genius exists. Intuitive genius exists. It's simply that we may not always identify it as genius. So when we have now technology that remembers everything for us, are we missing out on something that's fundamentally human? I mean, it's interesting, the views of technology, right? Because I hear what you're saying, that technology doesn't, you know, it's not a threat to culture and culture adapts and changes. But the way we've defined technology in the modern culture mostly has to do with, like, how can we manipulate matter? And what you're saying, for example, about the Tibetans is they define technology along completely different terms, like the technologies of consciousness.
I mean, I think it's, you know, none of this is either or.
Right.
And there's this tendency to sort of say, to either, you know, get into a space of self-flagellation if you're from the West, or idealization of the exotic other, you know,
right.
Or condemnation of the primitiveness of the other. And that's not what this is about. It's all about, it's not us and them. It's about we. What kind of world do we want to live in? Mm. And if you take, for example, Tibetan Buddhism, I mean, I made a film called The Buddhist Science of the Mind, and I specifically use that term science, because what is science but the empirical pursuit of the truth? And what is Tibetan Buddhism but 2,500 years of direct empirical observation as to the nature of mind?
So science isn't always what we think of as science. Technology isn't always what we think of as technology. And it's not an either-or game. The Lakota Sioux, as Davis said, did not lose their fundamental sense of cultural identity when they switched from the bow and arrow to the rifle. The point isn't to bash modern technology, but to also not hold it on some kind of unassailable pedestal. Perhaps ultimately to learn lessons about what's working and what's not, and ask ourselves, like Davis says, what kind of world we want to create.
But that said, the arrival of technology can create transformations. When the Skidoo or the snowmobile arrived in Baffin Island in 1962, coinciding with a distemper epidemic which had rationalized the slaughter of the dogs, it had a huge impact, because obviously you lost that continuity of knowledge between father and son in terms of the management of dogs. You had a people that became more tied to a cash economy, which led to settlement, which brought in all kinds of problems for the residential schools, to alcohol et cetera. So, you know, it's not an either or thing. You know, I mean, by the same token, were I to rip my arm off in a car accident, I wouldn't want to be taken to a shaman, you know? So it's not about judging one better. It's really asking, what kind of world do we want to live in? And how do we find a way that, you know, all of these intuitions of humanity can find a place at the Council of Human Knowledge? I mean, I'll give you a good example. I mean, I think where the West has gone wrong is in our treatment of the environment, and we think of something like climate change as being humanity's problem. Well, it's become a problem for humanity, but it wasn't caused by humanity. It was caused by a very narrow subset of humanity with a particular worldview, and we can trace without judgment or even criticism the genesis of that worldview in the West, you know, in Europe, you know, during the Renaissance and into the Enlightenment, when we tried to liberate ourselves from the tyranny of absolute faith, the power of the church, when we tried to liberate the individual from the collective, which was a sociological equivalent of splitting the atom, we threw away all notions of myth, magic, mysticism, and critically metaphor. And so when René Descartes said that all that existed was mind and material, in a single gesture, in a sense, he deanimated the world, to the extent that Saul Bellow would ultimately write that science made a house cleaning of belief, and the triumph of secular materialism sort of became the conceit of modernity. And the idea that the flight of a bird might have meaning was ridiculed, dismissed as ridiculous. And we began to see a mountain as a pile of rock ready to be mined, a forest as existing of cellulose and board feet ready to be cut.
What Davis is getting at here is the heart of the issue, and an issue that is right at the heart of this podcast. He speaks of looking back without judgment at the de-animation of the world. As he says, this de-animation was understandable and even somewhat necessary given the totalitarian power of the church. So we can look back with understanding at why it happened, and then we can observe the results of it happening.
The most important thing that we threw out was this notion of metaphor. You know, most human societies have interacted with the natural world through some metaphorical relationship. Now, what do I mean by that? We'll go back to the example of a forest. You know, I was raised in British Columbia to believe that a forest existed to be cut. That was the foundation of the ideology of scientific forestry that I learned in school and I practiced in the woods as a logger. Now, that may be very different than my friends amongst First Nations, people like the Kwakwaka'wakw, who believe that the forest is the abode of Hukuk and the Crooked Beak of Heaven, these spirits that would have to be embraced or engaged during the Hamut's initiation. Now, the important thing is not who's right and who's wrong. You know, is forest board feet? Is it domain of the spirits? It's a metaphor that is important. If a child is raised to believe that a mountain is an abode of a deity that will direct his or her destiny, as would be the case in the mountains of the Andes of southern Peru, they're going to have a different relationship to that mountain than a kid like myself raised in a belief system that believes that mountain is a dead body of ore ready to be mined. And the belief system mediates a relationship between the culture and the natural environment, often with profoundly different consequences for the ecological footprint of that society. And so we treat the world as we do because we see it in a certain way. We see the world as a stage set upon which only the human beings interact with every other form of life, every other object being reduced to but a prop in the human drama as it unfolds. That's not how most in other cultures view the natural world. You know, the Barasan and the Tucano in the Northwest Amazon, their most profound intuition is the idea that people are but plants and animals in a different dimension of reality. If you go to the deserts of Australia, you know, it's a perfect example of the antithetical way of thinking about the world. You know, when the British first arrived in Australia, they saw people that looked strange, had a simple material technology. But what really offended the British is that the Aboriginal people had no interest in improving their lot. And because improvement and progress was the essence of the ideology of Europe at the time, in their inimitable way, the British concluded that the Aboriginal people weren't human at all. And frankly, they began to shoot them. And as recently as 1902, it was debated in Parliament in Melbourne as to whether or not Aboriginal people were human or not. As recently as 1950s, ranchers had quotas as to how many Aboriginals could be shot with impunity who trespassed upon their land. As recently as the 1960s, a school book used throughout the curriculum in Australia, a treasury of fauna of Australia, included the Aboriginal people as interesting forms of wildlife in the country. And what was missing was the ability of the settlers to understand a profoundly subtle devotional philosophy, and that was the dreaming. And the dreaming wasn't a dream. It was the notion that the world at your feet both existed but was constantly waiting to be born in the realm of the dreaming, in part in the realm of the imagination. And the entire purpose in life in Australia was stasis. It was the opposite of improvement. The goal of life wasn't to change anything, but rather to do the ritual gestures deemed to be necessary to maintain the world exactly as it was at the time of its first creation. It'd be like if all of Western intellectual energy had been invested in somehow pruning the shrubs in the Garden of Eden to keep it just as it was when Adam and Eve had their fateful conversation. Now, again, I'm not saying who's right and who's wrong. Had humanity as a whole followed that devotional trajectory, we wouldn't have put a man on the moon. But on the other hand, we wouldn't be talking about climate change and our propensity to transform the life support systems of the planet. So the point is here not that they're good and we're bad or we're good and they're bad. It's that every culture has something to say and each deserves to be heard.
I want to talk just a little bit more about sacred geography, and you speak about, and you just spoke about this notion that a child that is raised to believe that a mountain is home to a protective spirit will be a profoundly different human being than a child raised to see a mountain as an inert mass of rock. You know, I think sometimes when we think of sacred geography or sacred environmentalism, we think, you know, well, that means let's all treat nature well. But what you're talking about, I think, goes deeper than that into a place where nature and specific natural features become the entire lens through which a culture or a person views the cosmos and their place in the cosmos.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the key word is reciprocity. You know, most cultures have this sense that they never see humans as part of the problem, but as an essential part of the solution, in the sense that, you know, it's not like these various indigenous people, and I'm not really even comfortable with that word indigenous, but people of place, shall we say. Mm-hmm. It's not like they have some kind of, you know, Rousseauian intuition about the earth, as if they're more bestial than we are, more wild, or they're more Thoreauian, as if they're more contemplative than we are. It's, you know, indigenous people generally are neither sentimental nor weakened by nostalgia. There's not a lot of room for either sentiment in the harsh winds of the Arctic or in the mountain slopes of the Himalaya. You know, nomadic people, the rainforest like the Penan in Sarawak, don't have overt and conscious notions of roles of stewardship. You know, in a landscape, they lack the technology to severely impact, but their relationship with the natural world is based, I think, on a more subtle intuition, this idea that in some sense the entire world is breathed into being by the human imagination, that plants and animals are players on the stage of history. Like I said, the Bonasana literally believe that humans are just plants and animals in another dimension of reality. The Kogi and the Arawakos and the Wiwa and the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta in Colombia, you know, literally maintain that their prayers maintain the cosmic balance of the world. So they don't see human beings as a problem, but as an essential mediator. And I think you could say the same thing about Aboriginal people in Australia. And so it's not that human beings have no impact on the world. It's that they have a profound sense, which is frankly the truth, that, you know, human beings deserve the bounty of the earth. But in exchange for that bounty, we have reciprocal obligations to the world. And I think that plays out very strongly in Andean Peru, where it's not difficult to believe that the earth is in fact alive. After all, it's so dynamic with earthquakes and landslides and sudden frosts that can wipe out the agricultural labor of a year in a few minutes, or hailstorms or whatever. So there's this very strong sense of the mountains being alive. I mean, people see clouds gather in the valleys and condense on the mountains that bring rain, that brings fertility to the fields. So it's all around you. So these ideas have emerged. And again, it's not that people don't cut down a tree or that they don't till the soil. It's quite the opposite. They do all of the above, but in a state of kind of reverence, with recognition that there are limits and that the earth must be steward. You know, that there must be a kind of a give and take between the earth and human beings. That sense is utterly missing in a Western way of thinking, in which we've reduced all things around us to inert commodities ready to be exploited at our whim. And that goes deep into our Christian tradition and the way we've treated the world. And it probably wasn't the way that people thought about the world in the earliest years of life in Europe, but it certainly became that. Again, and again, it's not that it's somehow evil that it became that, because the Enlightenment gave us this great methodology of science, which has brought us great wonders. It's so none of this is to be judgmental. Mm. It's really, or to condemn the past or to judge the past by the standards of today, but rather as we begin to move forward and ask ourselves, how are we going to live in a multicultural, pluralistic world? You know, what, you know, how is it that we can recognize that these other cultures have something to say and they deserve to be heard? That's really the question before us.
I understand what you're saying about it not being either or, and I think that's really important. But how, you know, there is a cultural view that seems increasingly dominant in the world these days, and how can we expand our repertoire of the possible or our repertoire of ways of seeing the world? How does it work in practice?
Well, I think that in fact the world is changing. Look, when I was young, just getting people to stop throwing garbage out of a car window was considered an environmental victory. Nobody spoke about the biosphere, biodiversity. Now those terms are part of the vernacular of school children. You know, within my lifetime, women have gone from the kitchen to the boardroom, people of color from the woodshed to the White House, gay people from the closet to the altar. I mean, change is happening all around us at a tremendous pace. And I think that don't forget, again, that, you know, the vision of the Earth from space that people will be speaking about 10,000 years hence only first came to us on Christmas Eve of 1968, when I was already, you know, what, 14, 15 years old. In other words, you know, I think we're somewhat impatient with the pace of change. But, you know, since that sense of the Earth from space, everything has changed.
It's worth remembering that view of Earth from space that Wade Davis is talking about here, that view of the one planet, the blue oceans, the green continents, the swirling clouds, all united in one perfect sphere. This really is a recent vision of humanity, a connected humanity. And within this connected humanity, there are many things, as he says, that are changing. The concept of global human rights, the idea that everyone from whatever walk of life has basic rights that they are entitled to. And in the midst of this, the fact that we are exposed to and can learn from these magnificent ways of seeing the planet and seeing our role within it, that we can learn from the 7,000 extant languages on the planet today, 7,000 worldviews, 7,000 attempts to answer the question, what does it mean to be human? In the midst of all the bad news out there that we are witness to every day, it's important to remember that positive change is happening. Worldviews are shifting. As much as there is division, there is a sense of global uniting as well. And transformation is possible. It may simply necessitate a new way of seeing. Thanks so much to Wade for taking the time to talk. He will be on other upcoming episodes in which we talk about the shamanic crisis experience and, of course, Haitian voodoo and the origins of rock and roll. Wade Davis has got many wonderful books out there. One River focuses on his journeys into the Amazon basin. There's The Light at the Edge of the World. There's The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in a Modern World. And of course, The Serpent and the Rainbow. You can find his books in all the usual places. If you liked what you heard today, please consider becoming a patron. You can find out more at patreon.com/theemeraldpodcast. That's Patreon, patreon.com/theemeraldpodcast. There are patronage levels starting for as low as $6 per month. And patrons get a variety of benefits that are listed on the site. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and until next time, may we live lives that are driven forth by imagination, vision, and wonder.